evening or morning or afternoon, whatever time it is where you are. This is Tom Harris, and welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 27. It's very kind of hot and muggy in Chicago right now. Anyway, without further ado, I just want to thank everybody for your comments, and I will be reading out some mails and some comments next episode, but I just have a little bit too much material to cover in this episode, so I'm just going to get in right to it. So briefly last time, we talked about what is science and compared it to religion. And we talked a little bit about the scientific definition of a theory and the colloquial definition of a theory. Now, those are two very important things. Now, when I closed the show last time, I was talking about the creationist. And I'm not talking about everybody who believes that you know, a supreme being created the earth. But a very specific subgroup of young earth creationists coming out of the evangelical tradition who are, they spend a lot of time trying to debunk science. And in return, they give us some very dubious, quote-unquote, science of their own. This movement started in the 1960s. It's not something that's been around for many, many years. A lot of these creation scientists do not have any scientific credentials, or if they do have scientific credentials, it's usually in a field very much unconnected with things like creation, evolution, etc. And I think I concluded the last episode by saying, you know, basically, they don't formulate hypotheses, they don't do research, they don't do any science at all. And it's important to bring this stuff up for a reason. Now, I had a comment the other day from my friend Matthew in Chicago here. Matthew was saying, you know, as easy and fun as it is to poke holes in Christianity, it actually gives, you know, Christians a forum to have a dialogue. I'm not afraid of that dialogue. I welcome the dialogue because I know that if you explain to people the truth of the situation, they're going to understand it. I'm not against religion. Like I said before, people's religious beliefs, I mean, that's their own business. It has nothing to do with me. And as long as they keep it out of my business, I'm fine with it. Now, the reason why it's important in the context of this discussion is because these creation scientists, often helped by people who have kind of bought into their teaching, are trying to force it on the rest of us. They're doing that by either trying to alter science textbooks to eliminate any mention of evolution, or even worse, by trying to insert their religion into the science classroom under the guise of something called intelligent design. Now, intelligent design is nothing new. It's teaching the Bible. And as much as the so-called creation scientists try to deny it, that's really basically what it comes back to. It comes right back to the book of Genesis. And there's all sorts of resources all across the internet that you can use, and real books as well. It's not just something you're going to find on the internet, that explain this far better than I can. But essentially what they do is they sponsor candidates to go and run for local school boards. And these people on the school board level, that once they get a majority, they change the rules to make it easier for religion to be taught in the science class. Now, this is the sort of thing that I'm against, and I'm going to very respectfully disagree with Matt here. I think that if you don't challenge this stuff, then you are doing a great disservice to our society. We need to remain on the forefront of science, and when you have science deniers determining what is in our science textbooks, that's a problem. So, you know, we need to keep religion and science separate. And that's a point that somebody else made, and I'll talk about these comments next time. So I'm going to talk about Noah's Ark. And this whole thing started because I wanted to do a Noah show. And it's all sort of spun way out of control, and I really haven't talked about Noah very much. The creationists, and I'm speaking here strictly of the young earth creationists, place a lot of importance on the story of Noah and the flood. Now, I know, you know, even the old Earth creationists, you know, people who believe that, that God created the Earth and then let evolution take over. I mean, there's a lot of people who believe that. And you know, this is not directed at them, like I explained last time. But the young Earthers, they believe that the Earth is about 6,000 years old. They get this date from Bishop Usher, who back in the Middle Ages determined what he said was the true age of the Earth by tracing back these mythological genealogies that are in the Bible. So this is kind of where they come up with the general age of the Earth. Also, you know, using the same timeline that Bishop Usher came up with, have determined that the Great Flood happened about 4,000 years ago. Now, it is kind of a problem, now, because 4,000 years ago was about 2,000 B.C., and the civilizations of Egypt, the Mesopotamian region, and China were already very well established by this point. So, obviously, there was no flood in that historical period of time. But, of course, the young earthers are not going to be dissuaded by something so trivial as history. So you have to go even a little bit further. It's not hard to debunk Noah's Ark. It's very, very easy. And I'm just going to talk about a couple aspects of it. There are dozens of ways to disprove Noah's Ark. I'm going to concentrate on two. First, I'm going to talk about the ark itself, and then I'm going to talk about the logistics of getting the animals on. It's really quite extraordinary because the young Earth creationists place so much importance on the flood story. It's undeniably the weakest link in the young Earth creationists' teaching because it's so easy to disprove. But it's also the most important event. It's a key event. In there, so you disprove the Noah's flood and the rest of their, you know, biblical literalism, it collapses. Now, I understand all the proof in the world is not going to dissuade these people from believing what they believe, and really this isn't the point, because I know that I will never be able to dissuade somebody like Kent Hovind or Ken Ham from believing that the Earth is 6,000 years old. That's not my intention. But there's a lot of people out there who are, you know, otherwise intelligent people who believe what Kent Hovind or Ken Ham says. So that's why I feel it's very important to challenge bad ideas. And it's not being against religion, and it's not being against Christianity. It is being for being reasonable and thinking intelligently. And not just believing what somebody tells you. Well, as you folks know, I'm a big proponent of doing your own research, going out and reading and learning and discovering what you can discover. There's a number of very, very good resources out there for discussing the creation and evolution debates, etc. I don't want to go too heavily into this. The show is about Noah's Ark, and there's just so much material out there that it's impossible to go through it all. I mean, that's why I've got to restrict my Noah discussion to just a couple different topics, because there's just so much out there that it's just hard to talk about it all. But you should never just take one person's word for it. I mean, go out and learn as much as you can from both sides and you know, become informed. Now, one of the big problems, as I see it, is that people aren't willing to do that. They're not willing to go out and do their own research. Tend to look for sources that are only sympathetic to their own predilections, or they're just going to believe what they're told by people who they trust. In a lot of cases, it would be, you know, people in their family or the church or whoever. So that's why I say, go out and do your own research and learn about this stuff on yourself. Don't be lazy, especially when it comes to things like the flood. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, well, there's not too many people out there who believe in the flood anymore. To be honest, that's not really true. There's a lot of people out there who do. Now, I understand that a great many biblical scholars, and I do mean, you know, a large, large number, regard the Noah's flood story as a parable or as a allegory. They don't regard it as a literal historical event. And it's become very clear over the last 200 years, 300 years, that it is just a story. Though there are some people who cling to this. And not even out of a sense of tenacity, though I'm sure that there are some people who are just in denial and they know that it's not really true, but also people who just believe it out of ignorance. And I'll give an example, actually. Back about 2002 or thereabouts, I was involved in a theater website, and this was for people who were, you know, auditioning for various theatrical productions in and around Chicago. And I was there because I had just started my theater company and was kind of active in the forums there. And there was a young man named Michael. And Michael was a complete stranger to me at the time. And we started talking because he was saying he was moving to Chicago. He wanted to come to Chicago and do theater here. After, you know, a few weeks of discussion, I invited him to come and crash on my couch. So he did. And in the context of the 4 days I think he was here, he was looking for an apartment. So he'd be out during the day when I was at work, and then we'd meet after I got off work and come back here. I didn't give him a key. So in the context, he saw that I had a lot of Roman coins around my apartment, because I do. I have a whole bunch of Roman coins around my apartment. I have like 600 of them here. At that point, I was kind of busy doing some cleaning of the coins, not cleaning my apartment. I never do that. In the context of the discussion, he made a comment that I thought very, very odd. I was kind of explaining how the coins, they, you know, what would happen when soldiers would go off into battle, and they would bury their coins either in a jar or in a like a burlap bag, and they would bury them, and then they'd come back and dig them up later. And if they were killed in battle, then the coins would just kind of be lost, and they'd be there in the ground. And he made a comment, I bet the flood buried a lot of them, too. And I just couldn't quite believe what I was hearing there. And it's like, what? The flood? What are you talking about? And he said, the flood, Noah. And it's like, oh, my God. He thought that the Roman Empire had been destroyed by Noah's flood. And I can hear the groans. I mean, this guy wasn't really stupid. I mean, maybe he was a little stupid, but he just believed something that he was told. He never cared enough about it to actually go and investigate it. And it wasn't worth my time to argue with it, and I just kind of laughed about it. But there are a lot of people out there who believe in Noah's flood just because they haven't ever bothered to educate themselves. So that's why I think this is important. So let's talk about the flood. Basically, it starts in Genesis chapter 2. In the first chapter of Genesis, God creates the earth in six literal 24-hour days and rests on the seventh, creates man and the animals and the oceans, etc. Then eventually people have bred and kind of spread out all over the earth, and God thinks that they're all wicked. He decides, just out of spite, he's going to kill them all by flooding the entire earth. So he finds the one decent, good person on earth, which is a man named Noah. And Noah and his wife have three sons. And he says, Noah, I'm going to destroy the earth. You need to save yourself and a sampling of the animals from the earth. So they build this huge boat called the Ark out of gopher wood, and they give a description in the Bible of what the Ark looked like. And then they gathered the animals, mostly two by two, but of some animals there were as many as 14, and they jammed all these animals into this 450-foot wooden boat, and God made it rain for 40 days, 40 nights, and the fountains of the deep came spurting up, splooshing up out of the center of the earth, and the whole entire earth flooded. Now, a lot of people, when you say the Noah flood, they think 40 days and 40 nights. Well, the flood actually didn't last 40 days and 40 nights. The flood actually lasted for about a year. I think it was 290 days or something that the Bible says that the flood lasted. I'm speaking from memory, so those of you, you go back to Genesis and you can correct me if you want. Basically, this ark was floating around on this water for about a year. before the water receded. And there's a story how he releases a dove and it comes back with a leaf, and they know that it's soon that the flood is ending, and then they let the dove out and it brings back a branch, and then they let the dove go a third time and the dove doesn't come back, and that's when they know it's safe to land. And this is all taken directly from the Sumerian story of Gilgamesh, right down to the dove bringing back a leaf when he releases him from the boat. But we'll just ignore the syncretic origins of the flood story for a minute. Let's talk about the specifics. So according to the young Earth creationists, the Earth before the flood and the Earth after the flood were very, very different places. And I'm going off of information from Kent Hovind, Ken Ham mainly. There's a couple others, a couple other resources they're quoted. You can find a lot of this stuff on the Talk Origins FAQ and in the archives. There's a lot of the stuff is all documented. If you have questions, I can try to find individual quotes. According to Ken Hovind, Earth was surrounded by this giant canopy of vapor or water surrounding the Earth out in space. And because this vapor canopy was there, it caused the oxygen levels inside that canopy to be raised quite a bit. So his guess, it's not even really a hypothesis, but his teaching is that before the flood, people and animals grew to an enormous size and to an enormous age. Well, the Bible does talk about people being 900 years old. Most famously, Methuselah being 975 years old. Noah himself was 940 or so. And Adam lived to something like 960. Now, we know why the writers of the Bible did this. It actually comes from an older tradition of giving people extreme ages to deify them. And then the closer you get to the modern day, the more reasonable their ages are. But we'll just ignore that. It's another example of syncretism, which I talked about way back in like episode 9. But so before the flood, people and animals grew to an enormous size. The Bible says there were giants in the earth in those days. And the speculation, of course, is that dinosaurs were nothing more than giant iguanas and anoles and all these other things, easily disproven by even the cursory examination of any fossil in any museum. But that was the point of Hovind's thing, is that in this oxygen-rich atmosphere, people grew to enormous size, hence dinosaurs being so large. And also things like giant beavers, giant elk, and other things that we find in the fossil strata. Now, they're giant compared to versions we find on Earth today, but we're not talking, three stories high. We're talking, maybe 50% larger than elk that you find today. In the process of this vapor canopy collapsing and falling to Earth over 40 days and 40 nights, the atmosphere of the Earth changed quite a bit. Now, the way that Ken Ham and Kent Hovind explain it, this oxygen-rich atmosphere changed. Now, it is actually true that if you were to have a vapor canopy surrounding the Earth, that there would be a richer gas content in the atmosphere. I mean, it would have changed the atmosphere. However, if you had enough water to rain for 40 days and 40 nights, it would have, the gases would have been at a toxic level, and therefore life would not have been possible on it. And secondly, when the water fell, remember, this is water falling from space, not water falling from clouds that are only a few thousand feet up. The water would have become steam, and everything on Earth would have been boiled. There would be no need for a flood. You'd have hard-boiled animals, along with Noah and his family and all the animals in the ark. Hovind also believed, as a result of the flood, all of the continents shifted drastically. He believes that all of plate tectonics was done during the Great Flood, which does kind of beg the question of why the Appalachians are so much older than the Himalayas. If they were all created at the same time, why does the Appalachians appear so much older? The Grand Canyon and all the mountain ranges and Niagara Falls and all this other stuff was created during the flood. All the sedimentary layers were created during this time, which would mean that by a process of billions of miracles, all happening all over the period of the time when the flood debris was settling, that God actually chose to put all of the animals in the fossil strata in a specific order that was specifically designed to mimic the evolutionary development of life on Earth. I mean, you don't find any bunnies down with the dinosaurs. It just doesn't happen. So therefore, God did this on purpose just to fool everybody. I don't know about you, but when I was a Christian, I sure didn't believe in a God that was a deceiver and a liar. Obviously, science is very clear that this is not what happened, but, you know, there's no arguing with these people, so we're just going to continue as they say. So after the flood, all of the continents are in a different position, and you have all these animals on the ark and so forth that are pretty far away from their natural habitats, most of them, which means that somehow all of the kangaroos and the wallabies and the emus and the koala bears somehow had to make it all the way from Mount Ararat in Turkey to Australia. How did that happen? Food for thought there. Let's talk about a little bit about the Ark itself. Now, the Ark was supposed to be, and I'm going to look up a reference here. And this is actually from an article on a site called No Answers in Genesis. The generally accepted size of the Ark is 155 meters long, 25 meters wide, 15 meters high. Now, three decks, a side-opening door, and a one-cubit square window atop. A cubit is a form of measurement whereby it's a measurement, it's roughly the space between a person's elbow and the tip of their middle finger. And if you're a giant person, as Kent Hovind thinks existed before the flood, it may have been much larger than that. So this is actually much larger than any modern wooden boat. You know, obviously the wooden ship era is kind of over now, but the largest wooden boats in the 19th century was about 300 feet long. And wood is not a great material for building a ship. And the reason why is because it's not very sturdy. It's flexible. And the longest wooden ships, they were about 300 feet long, and they required massive reinforcing with iron straps and so forth. And even then, they had to be baled constantly because there was so much leakage. So when you talk about a 450-foot-long boat, and this is in Genesis 6:15, by the way, it's clear that this ark, made with primitive materials in a pre-Iron Age environment, could not possibly have been seaworthy. Now, there's not really any good description of the stuff it was made of. We know it was made of something that they call gopher wood. Well, nobody really knows what gopher wood is. It's one of those things in the Bible that we just really don't know. But apparently it must have been real tough wood in order to endure that kind of stress. Now, one point of interest that somebody brings up is he would have had to have housed the 10,000 known species of termites on his wooden ark, which would be very interesting. Okay, so Noah had three sons, and three sons had wives. So basically, we're looking at a workforce of Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their wives. So you're talking eight people. So those eight people had to know how to build boats. They had to have the tools. They had to have access to forests of trees. They had to cut the trees down, transport the logs, saw the logs into planks, and that's not even counting the seasoning that you would have to, because normally when you build a boat, you have to season the timber so that it won't split, and people who build boats would know this. They would have to build the scaffolding, they would have to build the dry dock, they would have to build the vessel of very heavy planks. So they're talking about an enormous amount of wood, an enormous amount of sawmill. They'd have to have a sawmill. And remember, this is in a pre-Iron Age time. They wouldn't have had metal tools. They would be doing this with stones, or they would be doing it with copper axes, or, you know, like the ancient Egyptians. I mean, this would have been a very, very... daunting task with pre-modern tools. And even today, we couldn't make a seaworthy boat of that length. It just wouldn't work. You would have to have an enormous amount of thing. Now, the author of this website, and this is, I'm talking, it's called John Mark Ministries, he's talking about this. He asked a boat builder in Australia to provide with an estimate of building time with a workforce of four. And I'm going to say that the workforce might have been as many as eight. I mean, he's being a little sexist here. I mean, who's to say that Mrs. Noah and the son's wives couldn't have helped build? Basically, the boat builder said if they were to attempt a task 4,000 years ago of this nature, they'd still be building the boat today. And, of course, then the problem would be the parts of the boat would be rotted away by the time they finished to the part. So they would be constantly rebuilding the boat in addition to doing that. So already we have this incredible problem. These people could not have built this boat. Unless they were Superman, then you're talking about mythology yet again. Then, of course, you had to worry about, once you have a boat, it's assuming that you actually have a seaworthy boat by innumerable miracles. And of course, while it was afloat, you'd have millions of miracles every second to keep this thing from falling apart in rough seas at that. You would have to build the boat in order to carry not only Noah and his family, but roughly 30 million pairs of known and extinct organisms. Most of the young Earth creationists hold that dinosaurs were on the ark. Now, we don't even know how many different species of dinosaurs there are. We're discovering new dinosaurs all the time. But Hovind and those people tell us that the dinosaurs were on the ark, and therefore, there are way more than we know of. And we know of about 30 million species that exist that would have had to have been on the ark. The amount of fresh water for the animals would have sunk the ark, and I'm going to read right off the website here. The total amount of water carried for the animals would have sunk the ark. The total weight of provisions would have sunk the ark. The total weight of the invertebrates would have sunk the ark many times. The amount of excreta generated would have sunk the ark every 5 days. Furthermore, if a couple of the large animals had the urge to procreate, the ark would have become terribly unstable. So let's talk a little bit about loading the animals into the ark. On the assumption that the animals came in two by two and not in seven pairs. Now the Bible does say that clean animals, and there's a kind of a dispute over how many clean animals there were. There were as many as seven and maybe even 14. Either seven of these animals or seven pairs of these. So that's even more space. And remember, most of these clean animals are ungulates, things like cows and sheep. They're pretty big animals, generally. On the assumption that the animals came on two by two, each animal would have about 1,150 cubic centimeters of shipboard space for living 371 days at sea. That's about the size of a milk carton, by the way. Noah and his family would have had to share the tiny ark with 30 million pairs of known and extinct organisms, and that the Bible says that all these organisms were loaded in a 24-hour day, Genesis 77, verses 11 through 15, thereby requiring 460 organisms per second to enter the ark. That is one hell of a traffic jam, let me tell you. It's just incredible. Then you talk about the magnitude of just feeding the animals. Now, I read that one of the creationists, now this is completely, as though they realize the dilemma that they're facing here, has actually proposed that the animals were in some sort of suspended animation. But that's completely an unbiblical idea. Likewise, the theory, and this is something Doug from Akeley brought up, thank you, Doug, that one of the sites actually talks about how that Noah could have brought baby animals on board. Well, that's actually not biblical. That's actually against what the Bible says, because the Bible says very specifically that the male and his mate boarded together. Therefore, you kind of have that's some kind of indication that the animals are at least of sexual maturity. They could be young and maybe not full grown yet, but at least they're sexually mature. So you're talking about this enormous amount of animals squeezed into the size of a milk carton. You have to feed them, water them, and exercise them because they're at sea for an entire year. Imagine the amount of dung that is created by that, which would have to be carted by 8 people from the below decks of the ship and throw it overboard, presumably. You know, this is just the minimum that you would have to deal with. So I think we can kind of say, you know, Noah's Ark story is, let's say, it's a charming, charming story. It, you know, it's every kid remembers when they were a child having their picture Bible. I had one. I know a lot of other of you probably did too. Of Noah and the Ark and the rainbow and all this. And it's obviously, just by those two categories alone, an unfeasible story. What does that mean? I think this is actually the message here. What does actually does that mean for biblical literalism? And let's not also forget that these people would like to include this stuff in our science classrooms. What do you think? Let me know. The email address is tom@tomharrisusa.com. I would love to hear some discussion on this. I do have some comments already. I'm going to read those next time. And I think I'll have a few more statements, just closing statements to wrap up the topic. And I'm sure that we'll be coming back to creationism over and over again because it's a topic that I'm interested in and one that is always good for discussion. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the show because we're well over the time here, I believe. And so from Tom at Tom Harris USA, have a great evening. I'll see you next time.